The Capital Ideas podcast now has a new monthly edition hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin. Investment professionals reveal their best mentors, how they find their next great idea, and a few funny stories. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. American Funds Distributors, Inc.
This episode highlights from the Future of Everything Festival, where Wall Street Journal editors and industry minds examine how advancements in science and tech are revolutionizing business, culture, and society. This was recorded in front of a live audience on May 9th at Spring Studios in Tribeca.
The Future of Everything, a look ahead from the Wall Street Journal with Jennifer Strong.
For the first time in decades, space feels within reach again. There's a lot of energy and capital being put into various space programs and skills. And to talk about it, my colleague, The Wall Street Journal's Christopher Mims, joins Tim Ellis, Chief Executive of Relativity Space, and Joel Sersel, founder of Transastra.
So you are a Earth to space transportation company, and you are a within space transportation company. Maybe you can explain, each of you briefly, what your companies do, because I think it's so far out that this audience, even if they know you, could use a refresher.
Yeah, sure. So I'm Tim Ellis, the CEO of Relativity Space. So what we're doing is working to fully automate the production of rocket launch vehicles by actually 3D printing an entire rocket. Our long-term goal is to 3D print the first rocket made on Mars, and we've raised $45 million in the last year and a half, and have 23 people down.
And to be clear, you're already 3D printing very large objects.
We're actually building our own 3D printer. So it's the largest metal 3D printer in the world that we made ourselves, because in order to actually print rockets, like, it's got to be really big. And then we've done a whole bunch of engine tests as well of like fully 3D printed rocket engines.
And so let's talk about within space transportation.
Sure. So I'm Joel Sersel, CEO of Transastra Corporation. And we are doing the basic technology development and economic modeling and planning for in-space transportation enabled by asteroid mining. What we're going to do is we're going to turn thousands of near-Earth asteroids into refueling stations for spacecraft and build a transportation network in space. So the great 20th century science fiction author Robert Heinlein said, once you're to low Earth orbit, you're halfway to anywhere. So Tim's going to take us halfway to anywhere, and Transastra is going to take us the rest of the way. The key to in-space transportation is fully reusable spaceships, kind of like Elon Musk's BFR. But the key is, even with the BFR, 80% of all the cost, if you want to go anywhere, is launching propellant to space. So we're going to collapse the cost of in-space transportation. And part of our business model is public-private partnership with NASA. NASA has been a huge asset to Transastra. They've been funding us with grants and contracts with this wonderful thing that a startup CEO loves, which is undiluted funding. So we've developed the basic technology to mine rocket propellant from asteroids, largely with NASA partnership. And we've worked with NASA to plan NASA's future exploration based on asteroid mining propellants from a private sector company.
And just so we can visualize that, like, is this like space John Henry's drilling into asteroids in their spacesuits, or what does it actually look like?
We've designed an asteroid mining vehicle that we call the honeybee, because it works like a honeybee, goes out and collects nectar and comes back. And what it does is it gets launched on a rocket and has thin film inflatable structures that go and capture the asteroid in a bag. And then in space, the sun is much more reliable, much better power system than it is here on the ground. So we use solar reflectors to concentrate sunlight inside that bag. And I've invented something called optical mining, which is a way that you can excavate the material inside the asteroid, inside the bag, capture the gases that are released, and put them into tanks.
So
where they can use...
you're heating it up with concentrated sunlight.
Yeah, concentrated sunlight directly excavates the asteroid. And then we have ways of using that propellant in space as fuel to get around from place to place.
So let's take a step back to the more immediate future. Obviously, with SpaceX, their innovation is reusable rockets to lower launch costs. Everything's about lowering the tremendous cost of getting to space. You're another part of that. Can you tell me how we make rockets now and why that's so expensive and how you're going to do that differently?
Yeah, sure. So I originally came from Blue Origin before.
Which is Bezos' space company.
Bezos' space company. So I was a propulsion engineer and then started the metal 3D printing division there, which is
so propulsion engineering means rocket engines.
Designing rocket engines.
Yeah.
Yep, exactly. And then my co-founder was actually from SpaceX and worked on their 3D printed rocket engine program too. Mm-hmm. And so, SpaceX and Blue are both printing kind of a few parts of a rocket, but really the fundamental problem of why space is expensive is rockets are very, very labor intensive to build. They have like hundreds of thousands of individual parts.
I mean, it sounds like an F1 car
or a kit car or something. Like an airplane that you're going to throw away every time. So that's why reusable rockets make sense, because you're taking this very expensive thing and reusing it many, many flights.
But it's still this handmade.
Yeah.
I picture like a blacksmith hammering out the nose cone or something.
Yeah. There's like, you would kind of think for all of the automation that's at Tesla that like SpaceX would have lots of robots and be very automated. But the truth is it's not. It's just built by hand. And so our goal at Relativity is to actually fully automate the production process by using 3D printers. So really we view 3D printing as software-defined automation. Like in a lot of ways you're able to take these very, very complex assemblies and actually print them as like one piece.
So rocket building has yet to have its Henry Ford assembly line Model T moment.
Exactly. And if you kind of look at the future of like how we can actually get to this, you know, sci-fi fantasy of like really cheap launch and things happening in space, innovating on how rockets are actually manufactured is really the way to go, just because labor is still 80 to 90% of the cost of making a rocket.
So in the short term, how are you going to make 3D printing rockets viable?
We've actually already done like 100 engine tests of like a fully 3D printed full-scale rocket engine. It has this like beautiful kind of purplish blue flame. We're using methane and liquid oxygen as well for propellants. And then we've also already built like a full scale rocket tank.
And I mean, economically, who wants to buy your cheaper engine?
Oh, sure. So we're selling launches to low Earth orbit constellations. So
there's what are those for?
So they're really used for like telecom or internet from space. Mm-hmm. As crazy as that sounds.
Space Comcast, Space Time Warner.
Yeah, Space Comcast, Space Time Warner. And then also things like Google Maps, where you're going to take photos from space and not just sell like pictures, but actually do machine learning and have analytics of the entire world kind of on a daily basis. Or even a company just got started to do video of every point on Earth all the time, like perpetual video.
Perpetual space surveillance.
Yeah.
To like sub-meter resolution.
Yes, exactly.
I don't see anything wrong with that.
Yeah. It may seem a little scary, but if you do think about Earth and like the resources that are increasingly constrained, it makes sense that you want to optimize more of like the Earth as like a whole system.
Yeah, joking aside, that could like help us from starving to death in like a climate changed world.
Yeah. Exactly.
So
yeah.
You're going to be part of a lot of big things then. So I'm going to get 5G on my phone maybe thanks to 3D printed engines. So you have this pipeline and then you keep going. And then what's the ultimate goal?
Yeah, so then our ultimate goal is to 3D print the first rocket made on Mars. That was the reason I started Relativity, was I was quite frustrated seeing the amazing progress SpaceX has made in the last 15 years towards this goal of like making humanity multiplanetary. But we're then the second company that said this is our core mission to actually help out, because we believe there need to be dozens to hundreds of companies actually working on this problem with both a near-term Earth-based business plan, but then also has application on other planets.
So like the market for electric or autonomous vehicles, you need as many players as possible.
Yeah, exactly.
So we're in low Earth orbit. We've got these reusable, 3D printed, maybe there's some other innovations in there, like they're more reliable because you're building for reusability. So you've lowered launch costs by a factor of 10 or whatever. Now we're in low Earth orbit. Help me visualize, because my mental map, and I think most people's, hasn't been updated since like the Kennedy administration. I just picture giant rockets and moon bases and like space war. But what does it actually look like?
Well, so we're going to be mining asteroids that come drifting by the Earth-Moon system.
Mining like with rockets, or you've got we're going space to mine stations, with, or what?
So what we're going to do is we'll use rockets initially to launch the Honeybee spacecraft that I talked about. That's this inflatable structure that goes and surrounds the asteroid. It mines the propellant out of it, and it'll bring the propellant to a gas station at the top of Earth's gravity well, up where the near where the moon
like
is.
Like geosynchronous?
Way above geosynchronous orbit.
Okay.
And that's the ideal place to put a refueling station.
Why?
Because from there, you can drop down into the gravity well very easily and get to all different kinds of orbits. Mm-hmm. So we can drop down from there to low Earth orbit, skimming off the atmosphere to break. And we can pick up a reusable upper stage that Tim might have built, refuel it, and with the delta V that it has at that point, it can go anywhere in cislunar space, which means anywhere in the Earth-Moon system.
And delta V, just translate for
I'm
us.
Sorry, delta V, so I'm sorry, I'm a geek. Delta V is the parameter, the language that we use as engineers to describe how hard it is to get places in space. There's a common myth that the closest planetary body to the Earth is the Moon. And that's true in terms of distance. But in terms of delta V, the thing that engineers care about, in terms of how hard it is to get to, there are thousands of near-Earth asteroids that require less rocket propellant to get to than the Moon. And those are the targets that we'll be going for initially for harvesting rocket propellant. And so we can drop down to low Earth orbit. We can pick up satellites that have been delivered to low Earth orbit and deliver them to geostationary orbit, where the big communication satellites are. And we can increase the throw capacity of one of Tim's rockets that way by about a factor of 4. So instead of being able to launch, you know, a 500 kilogram satellite, he'd be able to launch a 2,000 kilogram
satellite.
In terms
of getting to Mars, obviously there's a tremendous cost for every pound or kilogram of mass you need to get from the ground to space.
Absolutely.
Like, what are you saving by whatever measure you like?
So NASA, this wonderful undiluted funding from our partners at NASA is very helpful. And so they funded us to do an economic study of that. And we showed that with this approach, we can save 3/4 of all of NASA's cost for its human exploration program. If it wants to build an outpost on the moon, explore asteroids with astronauts, or put the first astronauts on Mars. And the really cool thing about it is that by building this transportation network and these mining systems, it's kind of like building a railroad. Once you've got it in place, you can use it for other things. Mm-hmm. In fact, the business model for the Transcontinental Railroad is very much like what we're talking about for the solar system. We work with NASA in public-private partnership to build the transportation network for NASA's purposes, and then it's a commercial legacy product that's left behind. But actually, our market studies show that once that network is in place, space tourism to the moon becomes affordable. And so we could definitely envision a lunar hotel where the propellant is supplied by asteroid resources. In fact, Jeff Bezos has famously talked about building a hotel on the moon. My intention is to sell him the propellant that he can use to transport his tourists to the hotel.
You mentioned Bezos. He was recently pilloried for saying, the only thing I can imagine doing with my Amazon winnings is going to space. And people are like, I can think of some other stuff. Why should we continue to go to space when, I mean, it's the classic question. There's so many issues that we have to resolve on Earth, some of which are, frankly, existential.
So, you know, Bezos, Musk, Carl Sagan, who was somewhat of a mentor of mine, many other people who've looked at this have looked at space as the immortality project for the species. The Earth has a limited carrying capacity, and wealth is correlated with energy production and impact on the biosphere. But the solar system has a virtually unlimited resource for humanity. You know, people point out that the asteroids only constitute about 4% of the mass of the moon, but the vast majority of the mass of planetary bodies is not accessible because it's buried. But we and others have calculated that there's enough resources in the long term in the solar system, in asteroids and solar energy, to build worlds for humanity that have 1,000 times the carrying capacity of the Earth. So imagine 1 trillion people 1,000 years from now spread throughout the solar system. That makes humanity an immortal species. And that's really the mission. And Elon talks about this fairly openly, but everyone who's working in the area, Tim and I haven't chatted about it, but my guess is that's part of what your vision for going to Mars is.
Yeah, partially. I would say for us, I mean, it is, I would call it like a two-part answer. So one is just these low Earth orbit constellations of satellites that we would be launching initially, which really funds, like that's kind of what makes us become a multi-billion dollar company because the market size is so huge. And just really the thirst for data, I think, is a fundamental story to humanity ever since the internet was created. The thirst for data is huge. There's still actually over 3 billion people in the world that are not actually connected to the internet and to a lot of these like modern services. And so the idea with low Earth orbit constellations of satellites is that you can actually deploy internet to these unconnected populations much faster than you can actually build out fiber
networks. At a low enough cost.
Yeah, at a low enough cost. The cost will actually be quite low, by the way, for constellations. And one of the keys is lowering launch costs. Because right now, for these satellites, the launch cost is actually close to two-thirds to half of like the total cost.
The total cost of that system.
Yeah.
So I want to get to your second point, but first, I think this is worth emphasizing. It's easy to forget that space travel and research has always had very real terrestrial scientific and technological dividends. And honestly, like, it's one of the few things other than going to war, which we don't want to do, that give us benefits on that scale, right? Because we are pushed to do something totally novel, extreme, and unprecedented. In terms of like your massive 3D printing, having seen your systems with these giant spider-like arms and having looked at other architectural scale 3D printing, it seems like if you were to master that technology for rockets, honestly, rockets might be the least of what we end up building with that technology in terms of total mass or net impact on humanity.
Sure. Yeah, sure. So the reason rockets are the best first thing, besides the fact that me and my team have a background in rockets, is so with 3D printing, you're actually incentivized to make things very lightweight. Like, they actually print faster and are cheaper the lighter they are. And so it turns out a rocket is like a very lightweight, very expensive thing that you can actually then sell for a lot of money and actually have a very like concrete, not pie in the sky business case for rockets. But it is true, if our long-term goal is to 3D print rockets on Mars and make this factory that can make kind of like everything on another planet, because you're not going to have a lot of people and you're not going to have a lot of resources, that it turns out those same economic parameters mean the factory we're making to print rockets on Earth is also helping solve a lot of those issues of labor shortages. There's less than 100 flights per year to space currently, but then 100,000 airplane flights per day. So we're just really not.
So we could end up 3D printing these flying cars that we keep hearing about.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think actually over time, I would very confidently make the bet everything that flies will become 3D printed or become kind of automated
in this way. Because of those
lightweighting technologies. Yes,
because that are unique to 3D printing.
Yeah, because you can use the strongest materials and the lightest weight structures that actually more closely mimic nature over time. Like, some of these 3D printed structures look crazy.
Right. And it's biological.
Like a
tree.
It's like Westworld.
Vascular.
Yeah, it's like Westworld for rockets. I mean, that's what our 3D printer looks like. Mm-hmm. We have the same kind of robotic arms.
Right.
It's
fewer
cool.
Human rights violations.
Yeah. Fewer human rights.
So I want to throw the last question to you. What about any nearer term terrestrial applications that have fallen out of your research?
We're focusing primarily on space applications. We have some near term companies that we're spinning off, but they're still in stealth mode, so I'm not going to talk about them.
So we'll hear more about that.
But we intend to be demonstrating optical mining on the space station within 2 years.
On the ISS.
On the ISS, hopefully in partnership with NASA.
How big is that going to be? Is it like a?
It's going to be a relatively small demonstration. Mm-hmm.
Solar collector.
Like the size of this. And then hopefully thereafter, we'll go quickly to asteroid mining. We're also working on telescope technology for prospecting asteroids. But, we are on the cusp of a big transformation in the space industry. The whole global space industry is only about $300 billion a year, so a little bigger than Apple Computer.
That's like
right
the size
now.
Of, that's smaller than digital advertising.
Absolutely. But with Elon's plan to move the internet backbone into space, because of drastic reductions in fabrication cost and launch cost, the space industry is going to become a multi-trillion dollar industry over the next several years. This is, if you think space is exciting now, it's just about to
so
get really
be space
exciting.
Jobs and, space
and these big constellations are going to require lots of propellant, and it's still going to be expensive to get that propellant into orbit. Transastor will be selling that propellant from asteroids to the constellations that he puts up.
Let's stop there because we're all out of time.
Okay.
But thank
okay.
you both.
Awesome.
Thank you very much.
The Future of Everything is a production of The Wall Street Journal. This episode was produced by Anthony Green, Ryan Gutierrez, Kristen Schwab, Laura Sim, and Garrett Crow. John Wurdock is the executive producer of WSJ Podcasts. Stan Parrish is the editor-in-chief of The Future of Everything. We had help with this episode from The Wall Street Journal's Nikki Waller and Kim Last, with special thanks to festival organizers Karen Annis, Catherine Sterling, Andrea Acosta, Robin Wood Saylor, and Anna Rafdahl. Thanks for listening. I'm Jennifer Strong in New York.
What do the most successful growing businesses have in common? They're working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.